Okay, so thanks very much for the invitation to be here. Well, Scott asked me to give a slow and detailed proof to why Ising model is conformally invariant, and I thought that nevertheless some introduction is due. So what I will do, I will use first 25 minutes of my talk and slides from a different talk to give sort of an introduction, because some things are easier if I picture them not on the blackboard but just give a pre-prepared pictures. And then I will switch to slow and detailed proof, and as you will see, the proof is such that indeed one can probably give most of it in 1 hour. So I will just skip very fast to some first slide which is suitable here. So basically this grew up of my project to try to understand why a bunch of models should exhibit conformally invariant behavior in the scaling limit. And what I will be speaking about are sort of two families of loop models, which include most of the well-known two-dimensional lattice models, in particular all the ones which are listed here, percolation and Ising and Potts and spherical and Ashkin-Taylor and Fortuyn-Kestelin, etc. So we are basically, maybe it's better to skip directly to the examples, but we'll be speaking, I presume everyone knows what a lattice model is. Here most models are either random cluster models or spin models. So basically in spin models we speak of random quark covering of a lattice, like one pictured here. So one collation at critical value of P. So for every hexagon we toss an unbiased coin and cover it blue or yellow. So the first family which includes this percolation is the so-called O of N loop gas. And the name O of N, if you don't know, stands for orthogonal group in N dimensions, because this is sort of a generalization when you take spin not plus minus 1, which then would be a point on a one-dimensional sphere, a sphere in one-dimensional space, but you take spin which is point on a sphere in n-dimensional space. And then these models, that is already hard to picture with two colors, but there is a representation of these models, not immediate or trivial, as a bunch of loops, and this is what we'll be speaking about. So the model goes like that. We take some part of hexagonal lattice, and configurations are families of disjoint simple loops. So they don't need to include all vertices. So for example, there is a vertex here which is not included, so there are loops. And then there are two parameters, weight per loop, which is n between 0 and 2. One can actually take between minus 2 and 2 with some care, and h weight x, which is positive. So a weight of a configuration is n to the power number of loops, x to the power number of edges. So the partition function is sum of such things. So a probability, the probability of a particular configuration is n to the power number of loops, x to the power number of edges for this particular configuration divided over this sum. So to our purposes, it's better to consider this with a Dobruschen boundary condition, meaning that besides loops, we have a curve which is runs from A and to B. So there are fixed 2 points on the boundary, say source A and sink B, and there is also one loop which goes from A to B. Well, it's not a loop, it's a curve, but we can, for example, add an edge which goes from A to B, and then there is a loop which includes this edge. Yes?
Sorry, question. What is the contribution of the motion?
The compression. No, it's just very in conformal invariance business. There is no contribution of Dobruschen. It's just sort of that I don't have to say boundary conditions such that at A and B blah 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 blah, and those are called Dobruschen boundary conditions because it relates more to the yesterday's talk, because he used such boundary conditions to create non-trivial Gibbs states. So basically, before passing to a limit, he took in a, say, in a cube condition, so that the above equator you have plus spins, below equator there is minus spins, and then there is this sort of interface in between, and then somehow it's preserved in the limit and you have non-trivial Gibbs state. So I think there are people who know this much better than I do.
I think he probably is the first to give a rigorous proof in the dimensions.
Yes.
The interface is not rough.
Yes.
But these aren't the Brucean boundary conditions on the spins of the animal anyway.
Well, those are the Brucean boundary. Well, it depends. If you use high temperature expansion, no. If you take n equal 1 and you use the spin representation, so that would be low temperature expansion, then they are.
Only for n equals 1.
Yeah. Well, okay, I can. You should call them somehow. Well, okay, I can call A, B boundary conditions, whatever. Yeah, that's.
Wondering about.
Well, I think that it's easy to go back and ask who was the first person to consider sort of domain walls. Then we date back to the paper of Pyrrhus from 36.
Yeah.
And he didn't consider these things, he considered only loops. Yeah. Yeah, Pyrrhus contour, but it's running from A to B. Well, okay, so this is just a code word to identify this, because I think at least in 3D it's called Dabrushin boundary conditions. And now there is a conjecture which is sort of if you ask about conformal invariance of this particular interface, it was first proposed by Kager and Inhouse, but sort of conformal invariance for this model, it was it's maybe hard to sort of attribute to one person. And the conjecture goes like that if you change the value of x, there are two critical regimes. So there is a critical value of x, which conjecturally is this one, it was predicted by Ninhaus. And then there is a critical regime from the critical value of x to plus infinity. And on those two intervals, this model has a conformally invariant scaling limit. And a small remark that for x smaller than that, it doesn't have a conformally invariant scaling limit. So basically this, then you try to minimize the length of the curve AB. So the limit is basically a line with the Brown and Bridge deviations. And those two, they correspond to dilute dense phases. So we have in the limit the simple or non-simple curves. And just for those, most of the of you are, of course, very familiar with this. But, just a couple of particular cases of this model. So, as I said, you get this from a sort of non-trivial combinatorial considerations. But if n is equal to 1, there are different and much easier combinatorial considerations which identify this model with the Ising model. So for n equal to 1, we don't have loop weight. So the weight is just x to the power number of edges. Now, if we cover everything in two covers, which are representing Ising spins plus minus 1, then this weight is just x to the power number of pairs of neighboring spins, which are of opposite cover, because the perimeter of loops is just the number of blue-yellow pairs. And so this is a partition function for the Ising model. So usually x is denoted by exponent to the power twice beta. It's known, it dates back to Cramer's Vanier duality, and it was shown by Vanier that 1 over square root of 3 is the critical temperature. So this, in this case, the prediction of Ninhaus is rigorously known. So in that case, you get Ising model at critical temperature, Ising model on dual triangular lattice. And if you take x equal to 1, so this will be in the middle of this second critical regime, then you get that all configurations are equally likely, because this is just weight of every configuration is equal to 1. So this corresponds to the fact that we just toss an unbiased coin for every hexagon, and that's critical percolation on dual triangular lattice. So it's known, it's theorem of Wirman following Kesten, that critical probability is 1/2. So at n equal 1, we have those two models. And another thing which is worth mentioning, that if we put n equal to 0, so then the loop weight is 0, so we prohibit loops whatsoever, so only a curve from A to B is left, then with this conjecture on in-house weight, one gets a version of self-avoiding random walk. So I don't know whether I should elaborate more on this model, but basically the model we'll be speaking about, one of the two models we'll be speaking about, is this, that we take loop configurations on hexagonal lattice, and the weight of a configuration is n to the power number of loops, x to the power number of edges. Okay, the second model is the so-called Fortuyn-Kestelen random cluster model. So here I'll do it on square lattice. So here configurations are H configurations of square lattice. So we declare some edges covered blue in this picture open. And then the weight of configuration is q to the power number of clusters, that is connected sets of blue edges. So here there are six clusters, one very big, one smaller, and three 1-point clusters. So here weight is 6 to the power number, q to the power 6. And then there is another parameter edge weight, so this is p over 1 minus p to the power number of open edges. So again, it was sort of long assumed that if you take appropriate value of parameters, so here q should be between 0 and 4 and p should be critical, and here it's much more clear than in the previous model which value of p should be critical. It's still not known rigorously in most cases, but there is some sort of self-duality if p is equal to square root of q over square root of q plus 1. So it was assumed long that it's conformally invariant, and in the setting we will be speaking, I think it was first formulated by Stefan Rode and Adet Schramm, that the interfaces should converge to SLEs. And, well, this is a random cluster representation of Q-state-POTS model. Again, Q-state-POTS model is a generalization of Ising when we take not two spins, but Q spins. And then we basically do percolation on spin clusters, so percolation with those edges. So for Q equal 2, we get random cluster representation of Ising model. For Q equal 1, we get bond percolation on the square lattice. So for Q equal 1, there is no cluster weight. Critical value of P is 1 over 1 plus 1, so 1 half. So for for that case, basically, we just include with probability 1 half every edge. And by Kesten, it's known that this is the critical probability for percolation on square lattice. So for q equal 1, we just get at critical temperature percolation square lattice. And for q equal 0, we get uniform spanning tree. Maybe more about this later. So I just formulated this because here there is a sort of easy bijection between this and some loop model. So here how it goes.
And if there were open edges in the other
case? Well, the blue edge. So it's just we so configuration is a set of edges, which we call open edges.
All edges are open?
No, in this, blue edges are open, and this edge is closed.
I call them occupied edges, the links.
Links.
There is a link or no link.
Yeah, link. So whenever there is a link, it's open. Whenever there is no link, it's... So it's sort of a percolation language, because you assume that there is some current flowing over the open edges. So, for example, here, well, the thing is that what happens is that in, say, POTS model, Ising model, you speak about spin correlations. So you take two sites far away and you ask what is the correlation of spins there. Now, when you do percolation on a spin cluster, this translates into connectivity property, whether there is a path of blue edges from A to B. And what is logical to do, it's like in the first... On hexagonal lattice, we had this blue hexagon, and the complement was yellow hexagon. So here it's logical just to cover yellow all the edges which are not blue, but it's logical to do this on the dual lattice. So whenever there is no blue edge, we draw an orthogonal yellow edge. And then what we do, we take a medial lattice, which is a lattice which has centers of edges as vertices. And then we draw a collection of loops on this lattice, Hamiltonian collection of loops, which includes all edges, such that they don't intersect blue or yellow edges, so they go in between. So I think it's easier to show the picture than to explain what we do. So there is clearly a bijection between the two things, configurations of blue plus yellow edges here, or configurations of black loops, like here on the right. And what happens that one can rewrite partition function in terms of loops, and for arbitrary value of p you get that this weight which we used to have, so the weight was q to the power number of clusters, p over 1 minus p to the power number of open edges, it translates to square root of q to the power number of loops times some factor depending on number of edges. But if p is critical, that is equal to square root of q over square root of q plus 1, this second factor disappears. It is equal to 1. So for critical p, this model is equivalent to the loop model with this weight per loop. So it's very much like the loop model we had before. It's n to the power number of loops, x to the power number of edges. So here, it's automatically critical, so there is no second thing, so it's square root of q to the power number of loops. And again, we introduce these AB boundary conditions. So we ask... It's litigable for q less than 4, yes. For q more than 4, you don't have conformal invariance. It's a completely different story, and we won't be discussing it today. And the conditions here in terms of loops are that we ask for a loop from A to B, and if you formulate it in terms of clusters, it means that this arc from B to A counterclockwise is colored blue, and arc from A to B is colored yellow. So basically, if you do it in terms of the original spin model, it means that you have, let's say, plus spin boundary conditions on AB and free boundary conditions on another arc. But in the language of random cluster model, it's wired boundary conditions above and dual wired below. So that's the second model. I was thinking about scaling limit, and I never specified scaling limit of what, because it's, well, for example, in physics literature, it's never exactly specified what they mean by having conformal invariance scaling limit. So there are different things one can do. One can look at some observables like spin correlations, crossing probabilities, and one can look at scaling limit of one interface, or one can look at the full picture, some sort of a description like random height function of a loop or cluster collection. And I want to make two remarks. So we'll be mostly discussing scaling limit of one observable, because it turns out that implies one can build on the basis of its scaling limit of one interface, and probably also the full scaling limit. And another remark is that for some problems, actually, this intermediate number 2 is optimal, because we have a very nice description due to Odette Schramm of who are the possible scaling limits as silly curves. And they're very nicely adapted to calculation. So if you want to calculate something, then it's better to stop in the middle, because you don't maybe have enough information in one to really have very effective calculations of everything. And in three, you have too much information maybe to calculate something. So two, if you want to do calculations, two is the optimal thing. Okay. So, that's sort of a plan. What I plan to switch then to Blackboard and start with this random cluster representation of Ising model on square lattice, and discuss first how to find some discrete conformal invariant observable, then how to show that it has conformal invariant scaling limit, and how to construct one interface on the basis of it. There are some related topics which I have something to say about that probably won't have much time today. And one thing that here we speak about simple boundary conditions and a simply connected domain, but what I say, it actually generalizes to very general boundary conditions and interfaces on Riemann surfaces. And then for those who know the jargon of it, you get some SLE Kappa Ross scaling limits, so some SLEs with drifts. What I'll be saying, it superficially looks as if it's only, well, in one case for square lattice, in another case for hexagonal lattice. It is not. It actually can be generalized to other lattices, and there will be some technical difficulties, but mostly not in some exact calculations, but rather in a priori estimates. And then, if you have P non-critical, also there are some things which one can say. And also one can say, so I will be constructing an observable which depends on one point inside the domain, but one can do multi-point observables and say, for example, calculate spin pair correlations for the Ising model, at least deduce some equations for those. There are some generalizations of observables which seem to... Well, there are several ways one can try to pass to the full picture. And, there is a parallel proof for OFN model, but yet it is very different. And one of the nice things about it, that it explains, without proof, at least as of today, without proof, why these critical values predicted by Niehaus appear, these things like 1 over square root of square root of square root. And if time permitting, I will speak about that. And also, I can speak about why, what I will say, it works only for some values of Q and N. So what are the values of Q of N for which it works? So those are these two models, and for FK loops, there is a parameter square root of Q. Well, Q goes between 0 and 4, so square root of Q goes between 0 and 2. So the well-known models you get for Q equal to 0, 1, 2, and 4, so those are random cluster representations of four ports and Ising, and then there is bond percolation on the square lattice, and if you take Q equals 0, it's uniform spanning tree, and also one branch of it is Wupper race random walk. Actually, you don't need to take Q tending to 0. You can take Q exactly equal to 0, because we speak about Dobruschen boundary conditions, and it will be well defined. And for OFN loop gas, there are two critical regimes. So if we go from 0 to 2, and then from 2 to 0, we have, so for every parameter, there are two models. So for example, for parameter 1, as said, there is a percolation and easing. So essentially, the known things before were those two cases. I will speak today about proofs which, about methods which give alternative proofs of those two, and plus give two new cases. And, well, there are also some results which don't fit into this framework, so notably work of Adet and Scott about harmonic explorer and discrete Gaussian free field. Sorry? No, but here I wrote what is exactly what. So if you take n equal 2 and you take off n loop gas, it's not exactly discrete Gaussian free field. But in the limit, yeah, of course, it's like in some sense I was a bit wrong. It's not exactly self-avoiding random walk here with most definition, but it's sort of a version of it. But yeah, well, here you also can say that it's a four-state POTS model, but it's not exactly four-state POTS model. Okay, and the general relation between the SLE cup and N is given by this formula. So the formula. Okay, and here maybe I'll just show the pictures of how the interfaces in those models look like if you take this boundary data. So for kappa equal 3, you get a simple interface.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I saw it in your ICM.
Yeah.
Doesn't look
like
a
critical Ising at all, because critical Ising has
lots of clusters on both sides, which are comparable size to the whole interface.
Very
tiny clusters on
there. No, it doesn't have. Well, it's not a very good picture, because I was sort of pressed on time, and I have like perfectly equilibrated pictures which are better, than this one. But it's. I think it's actually okay. You shouldn't have a bigger size.
How big is your lattice? Yeah.
It's not a very big size of the lattice. It's probably like 200 by 200 at most.
Boundary conditions tend to depress or elevate.
No, the thing is that what happens here that
at a temperature which is actually not exactly equal to the critical temperature, it will look much more critical.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so this is at critical temperature, but since the lattice is small, it doesn't exactly look like it is at critical temperature. And the other thing that if you do this on a torus, you will have much bigger ions. But here they really, indeed, this boundary condition, they somehow push them inside.
It is because fixed boundary conditions tend to enhance correlations, and the torus tends to depress the current.
Yeah.
So if you play around with the temperature, then you could get something that looks much more critical. It doesn't.
No, I mean, if you do this picture really well, you won't have, for example, this small thing. So this is just an artifact, because I don't use nice algorithm. Well, I have a program which does nicer picture, but it doesn't do PostScript output.
His question, why aren't any large clusters?
But if for example, if we do it on much larger lattice, it will be less noticeable.
Oh,
yeah. But it yeah, that's.
I think the systematic corrections to the temperature you should apply to get a nice picture of
known. Yeah.
Well, I've got the darn solar.
No, I can show you a picture of a critical model without any boundary conditions, or of course.
But there will be larger clusters here.
Yes, but then it looks like it's actually in the order phase.
No.
Yeah.
But when you fix the boundary in one color.
By the way, someone has forgotten his watch here.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Ah, okay. Whatever. So, and that's a simple curve, and the other three models are non-simple. So for uniform spanning tree, you get a piano curve, which is space filling, and for the other two, so I didn't picture for FK using a cluster, but I pictured it for percolation. You can't actually see, because all clusters are pictured here, you can't actually see the cluster around which this curve goes. Unlike here, because the curve is not simple. So actually here there is a mess. Maybe I should change the coloring so that only one cluster is visible. Okay, so now we'll switch to the proof. So maybe I'll just show a few pictures. So what we want to find some conformal invariant, just some conformal invariant observable, like spin correlation or whatever crossing probability. So we need some sort of a discrete object on lattice which has some conformal invariance properties built in. So there are many continuum conformal invariant objects which can be discretized, but it seems that the sort of the best choice is to look at a discrete harmonic or discrete analytic function with prescribed boundary values. And the reason is that most other conformal invariants, like moduli of surfaces or capacity type things, they can be reformulated in this language of analytic functions which solve some boundary value problems. And also this is more accessible because you define some function of a point z and you ask it to satisfy, say, Cauchy-Riemann equation, or you ask Laplacian to vanish, and you ask some boundary value for boundary value problem to be satisfied, and just from that these local conditions you get some very non-trivial objects. And then the main question is, what sort of boundary conditions do we want to work with? So the usual choice are Dirichlet-Neumann boundary conditions. So either ask the function has prescribed boundary values, so that, say, normal derivative or maybe some derivative at some different angle is equal to zero. And those are nice because they are very classical. It's very clear how to discretize them, and it's there are old papers which date back to Listernik and Pelle and Wiener and Courant and Friedrichsen Levy, which deal with this case, how to pass to a limit in this case. But it's not a very rich choice of conformal invariants. So the better choice are Riemann-Hilbert or Riemann-Prival boundary value problem. So this is a problem where we ask. So basically, we'll deal with homogeneous case which asks for F to have prescribed argument on the boundary. And then you have a much wider choice of what you can get from this problem, but it's more difficult to discretize, to make sense of the discretization, and it's much more difficult to pass to the scaling limit. Another interesting thing that in this case you get, instead of invariant functions, you get invariant forms. So you get covariant functions, so you get some conformal invariants of this form, that f of z times dz to some power times dz bar to some power. Okay, so what is a discrete analytic function or prehomomorphic function? So it's maybe more logical to call it prehomomorphic, because analytic implies that you have a power series and there are no power series on the lattice. So we ask for some discrete version of Cauchy-Riemann equations to be satisfied. So the usual Cauchy-Riemann equation says that if you have a function f, then derivative in the direction I alpha is the same as derivative in direction alpha multiplied by I. So if you have derivative in this direction, then derivative in direction rotated by 90 degrees is just this times I. So the usual discretization, if we work with a square lattice, would be, well, to take, instead of the derivative, the differences. So we ask that for any lattice square, the difference along the red vector times I is equal to the difference along the blue vector. And basically, you can easily rewrite first 20% of any complex analysis book and with this definition. So because the sum of two prehomomorphic functions is prehomomorphic, and you easily get the derivative for integral, they are also prehomomorphic, well, they are defined on dual lattice, and you get maximal principle and mean value property and all that. And the only problem is that you cannot multiply divide the discrete analytic functions, because if f and g, they satisfy this equation, their product does not in general. And in particular, for example, you can't write Cauchy form or things like that. So whenever you have to divide or multiply, you cannot do it. So either you have to do it approximately, or you have to come up with a different definition for product. So usually what people did, the people who studied this, then they defined product of two functions not as a usual pointwise product, but some sort of convolution type operation which takes into account the values all over the domain and which preserved homomorphic property. But that doesn't...
Can you maybe
say a little bit more slowly what you mean by derivatives and
integral? Okay, so we'll need only integral, and it will be sort of self-explanatory when we come to that. But essentially, is it visible here for everyone? I think if I, Greg.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
That's where you can start. Exactly where you point.
Okay. Very good. So if we have values of our function at this, say, 4 points, let's say values a, b, c, and d, and suppose that we know that. Let's maybe start with the derivative. Then how we define derivative here? Well, the derivative here would be, it's better if I rotate the lattice, because otherwise I have some funny factors. So yeah, maybe. So A, B, C, and D. So how usually we differentiate the function f? So we just, in the usual case, f prime is just the partial derivative in direction x, or the same thing as I minus I times partial derivative in direction y. And, we can just say that we put in this point on the dual lattice number c minus a. So that would be derivative of our function at this point. And it's the same as d minus b times minus I by this condition. Now, if we continue, so for example here, if it's a, b, c, d, e, f, then here we put b minus f. If we have, I don't know, g, h, we put h minus b, and so on, g minus b. But then, we can use the other thing instead. So essentially, you have the same property as in the continuum case, that there is a derivative which is independent of the direction, and because of that it's well defined, and it will have all the usual properties derivative will have. So for example, the difference of values of f at 2 points will be the integral of the derivative along this path, but with respect to dz, against dz. So you have to multiply, if you go horizontally left to right, you have to multiply by 1, if you go vertically, multiply by I, and so on. So usually, there is one subtle point, so here we usually work not with the lattice which has step 1, but with the lattice which has step epsilon, and then we turn epsilon to 0. Then,
hold on, say that again. So how do you integrate? I guess you have to follow diagonal edges.
Yes, so if we integrate, then if we integrate, so for example we can integrate from here to here to here, and what happens to integrate from here to here, when we go vertically we must multiply by I, because it's dz, and dz is equal to I, and here it's equal to 1. So the integral, this blue, whatever color it is, integral is equal to I times b minus f plus c minus a. And I times b minus f will be the same as a minus e plus c minus a, and a disappears, so we get c minus e. And in any case, we would have some sort of telescoping arrangement like that. Yes.
Is there any analog of singularities?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's actually much easier than, whatever you can do without dividing, it's very nice. Basically, you can say that the difference of those two things is the d bar of f. So, for example, what is the Cauchy kernel? Cauchy kernel in the continuum case is a function which is globally analytic and has d bar equal to delta measure. So here you have something globally analytic, and on this square, d bar is equal to 1. So the difference of those two sides is equal to 1. That's an analog of Cauchy kernel. Because the bad thing, it doesn't have a nice form like on 1 over z. You can write a formula, but it's not like rotational invariant or something, and it's actually not immediate what is the formula. People spend
sort of position of the singularities on the dual lattice in some
sense. Yes, yeah. But relate a little bit later to these disorder operators and all that. So indeed singularity is on the dual lattice.
Is there a notion of harmonic where the real and imaginary parts are harmonic?
Yes. Yeah. Ah, okay. I forgot to put this property. Yeah, you are right. So the property which I forgot to put there is that real and imaginary parts are harmonic. Now, let me maybe prove it, and since Greg knows it, I will write it where Hida cannot see. So the way it works like that, that we take... actually, there is an interesting thing with this definition. It's not quite perfect, because if you look at it closely, you see that real part on blue vertices in this equation interacts with imaginary part on red vertices. So if you cover vertices into covers, the real part on blue vertices interacts with imaginary part on red vertices, and vice versa. So in some sense, you have two independent systems of equations. There is one half of your function, which is real on blue and imaginary on red, and there is another half. And a priori, there is no relation between them. So usually what people would, people in 50s, they would use terminology that this is a demi-function, that you take real part on blue and imaginary part on red, and they worked only with that. So in our case, there will be one more relation which will connect those two, so there is no such problem, but that's the case. Now, why real part is harmonic? So suppose it's harmonic actually on this blue lattice, so on the lattice where you take, so blue lattice of those things. So what does it mean that the function is harmonic? So the function is harmonic if it has mean value property, when the value at this point is the average of four neighbors. Now, what does it mean that it's average of four neighbors? It means that the sum of four increments, as I have drawn, so this difference plus that difference plus that difference plus that difference, is equal to zero. Now, by Cauchy-Riemann relations, this difference is equal to that difference times I. It's just the Cauchy-Riemann relation. And that difference is equal to the rotated difference times I. And that is equal to the rotated one. And that is equal to the rotated one. And they go in circle, well, in square. And so the sum of white differences is the sum, is it blue or red? I'm colorblind. Well, it goes around the it goes around the blue square, and so it cancels out. And it is harmonic. And it's also easy to show that if you have a harmonic function on blue vertices, then it has unique up to a constant harmonic conjugate on red vertices. So if you have harmonic function on blue vertices, there is a unique function on red vertices such that the sum of two will be holomorphic. It makes a very nice term paper for an undergraduate student who is following complex analysis course, because it's much easier than the usual complex analysis. But, it's much easier than the usual complex analysis, and indeed you can do many nice things, but you cannot do it all the way. So it would be very nice if someone would be able to do the full theory by sort of using some sort of notion of approximate analyticity, but for now it seems, in general case, it seems to be beyond reach. Okay, so that's the definition, and we want to find something which is related to the Ising model, which is a discrete analytic function of Z and satisfies some boundary values. Well, the function I was speaking of, it actually arises, if you can approach it from many directions. I've just listed some of those directions from which you get exactly the same thing, so maybe I'll just skip faster to the proof. I will maybe just draw. Well, I will just give the definition with one sort of pieces of motivation how one comes to it. And this piece of motivation is not needed in our proof if we do it in simply connected domain. But you need to do this if we want to do a series on Riemann surfaces. Then you need to do it as it is done here. So. First, we introduce a new parameter, so we have this square root of q weight per loop, and we take k such that twice cosine of 2 pi k is square root of q. And then what we do in our picture with loops, we orient all the loops. So this is a trick which goes back to Baxter. And if we orient loops, there are two possibilities for each loop. So one possibility is to take a weight square root of q over 2 per loop. And that would be the same model plus orientation. So instead we take a complex weight which would be exponent of I to pi k per loop, which is counterclockwise, and exponent of minus that for a clockwise loop. Then, of course, if we forget orientation, we add those two things together, and then what we get is just this, there are two complex conjugate numbers, and the sum is just the twice the cosine of this angle, so the sum is square root of q due to that formula. So, there is one problem with this thing, because we get a complex valued partition function and the total mass, so we don't get a probability measure, we get some complex measure with the total mass blowing up. But there is one very nice thing, that this partition function, it can be written locally. So the problem with the loop collections is that if I draw, say, some collection of loops, and then I want to calculate my partition function just for the path of the lattice, I don't know how to calculate it, because here, for example, I have three pieces of a loop. I don't know, it's, are those three arcs of the same loop or three arcs of three different loops. And here, with this complex thing, you can write it as a local product over all the sides of the lattice of exponent I, k, where times Weinig, that is the turn of the loop at this point. So, for example, at this point, the loop turns by 90 degrees. At this point, the loop turns by minus 90 degrees. So the weight per this side and per that side would be exponent of I, 90 degrees times k, exponent of I, minus 90 degrees times k. And if you take a product of such things along a loop, then if the loop is counterclockwise, then the sum of windings will come up to 2 pi, so you get this. If it's clockwise, it will come up to that. And if we project, if we forget orientation, we project back. Now, besides the loop, we have a curve which...
So, this definition, CC does involve the summation of the orientations a lot.
Here configuration is configuration of oriented loops. Well, it's related to this six vertex model, but there is a different real projection. So for those who know what a six vertex model is, that if we have it's the model where we draw pictures like that, but we forget how exactly loops are glued at this point, because this point, for example, can be done either like this or like that. This thing, there is another real projection where we leave the arrows but forget the how they glued, and then it still will be a real partition function but a different one. So there is also this kind of this reason for writing what we write.
Is this construction special for the critical point?
It's not, because because the other weight per edge is local. So in this model we don't have weight per edge, because the total number of edges is always the same, because loops cover all the edges. We had weight per edge on the original lattice, which is not quite visible when you draw the loops. But theoretically you can introduce it. It will be a local weight. It is a local weight because we just have to check whether this piece of the lattice, this side belongs to dual lattice, or the original lattice, spin lattice, or original spin dual lattice. So you can do that. Yeah.
But it doesn't enforce q less than or equal to 4.
This way it sort of enforces q less than or equal to 4. Yeah, that's what that's one of the reasons, yeah.
I mean, if you want to go away from the critical point of the pop model, you just give different weights for those two ways of linking up.
Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah, because look, those two weights, if you remember the original lattice, there was a yellow lattice and there was a blue lattice. And what happens is that in this case you have a blue edge, and in this case you have a dual yellow edge, which have different weights. One has weight p, one has weight p over 1 minus p, and another has weight 1. Or usually people write it as weights p and 1 minus p. So that's one of the things. And then, of course, the projection is not real. But we can discuss this later. That's an off topic. So what happens in this case that... we also have an interface because of the boundary condition, and it should be weighted differently because it's attached to the boundary, and the weighting should be like that. So instead of factor k, there should be factor of 4k minus 1. And even if you don't know the motivation for that, you can just try to plug in arbitrary factor L here, and once you start writing the proof, you'll be forced to take L equal to that. So we'll come to this in a minute. Okay. Now, what we do, I think I forgot here one remark, that if we have, well, the last remark, that the total winding of this curve from A to B is always the same. So if we have this curve which runs from A to B, the total winding is always the same because it can't really make any loops. So it just introduces some complex factor, which is constant and non-interesting. So what we do, we take some point Z in the middle, like say on the edge or in the middle of the turn, and we reverse in orientation of one of the halves. So we have now this picture, instead of picture of oriented loops and curve from A to B, we have picture with three marked points A, B, and Z. There are oriented loops, plus there is curve A to Z and curve B to Z. So picture is like this. And then what we do, we compute complex weight for that. So there are two possible interpretations of this. The first interpretation is with the original model. We take function f of z, which is the expectation that our curve passes through z, but taken with a non-trivial complex weight. So it's expectation that z is on our curve, and the weight is the winding of this curve from b to z, so in this particular case it's minus 90 degrees, times 4k minus 1. So different passages through z will yield different complex weight. Or another possible interpretation is that we have a slight variation of our problem. So what does it mean that we orient the loops? It can be translated into looking at a height function, so you just think that this is a geographic map with a contour line. So, for example, whenever we have a clockwise loop, it means that there is a hill here. If we have clockwise loop, then there is a hole there. And then if there is a curve from A to B, then it means that the right half is higher than the left half. But if we reverse this orientation, it means that when we walk around Z, we go plus 1 meter here and again plus 1 meter here, so we return to the same place but plus 2 meters. So there is a monodromy at that point. So if you write it in terms of height function, then this function f of z is just partition function of our model, but with plus 2 monodromy at z. So we look at possible height function which have this property: when you walk around z, you change it by plus 2. So that is not needed for a proof, it's just a much nicer formulation. So for the proof, we'll just use this definition of a function f of z. F of z is probability that we pass through this point taken with some complex weight. K is this funny number which... it's indicator function, yeah. Yeah. Well, I forgot what is the text symbol for this thing, and so So f of z is a probability that our curve passes through point z, but taken with sign. So there are complex. Yes. So maybe I would then just I was thinking of switching to blackboard, but this is the picture which is shows the sign. So this is the, for example, suppose that we pass through this point just by a straight curve, then winding is zero, so the weight is one. If we pass by a curve which goes like this, so the winding is pi, so the weight is that. Oh, there is one bracket missing here and there. And if we pass like this with the winding 2 pi, then the weight is that. So what happens for the Ising model? Then k solves this equation that square root of q is twice the cosine. So one can check that k is 1 over 8. And the sigma, so that's this 4k minus 1 thing, will be equal to 1 half. So the weights, minus 1 half, so the weights will, for Ising case, will be 1 minus I and minus 1. So if we come to this point with a full turn, it has weight minus 1. If with two full turns, it has weight 1 again, and so on and so on. Sorry? Yes, yeah.
It's a Fermion.
It's a Fermion, yeah. Yeah, a Fermion, yeah. Well, okay, it's related to the yeah.
The product of the order.
Yeah. Order. So So this is the theorem that as the lattice mesh goes to zero, this function has a conformally covariant scaling limit. The limit is the following. So we take a map phi of the domain omega to a horizontal strip so that A, B go to the ends. And this is something which is defined up to shift left, right shift. So derivative is uniquely defined. So f of z tends to phi prime to the power sigma. And there is, since we will do this sort of integration in the discrete case, we'll pick up the lattice mesh to the power minus sigma. So that is the theorem. Okay, and I think now I can switch to the blackboard probably, because, yeah, okay. So let us maybe leave this here, okay. Well, we can return it to it later, or... Okay. So I think I'll just... sketch how the proof goes. Well, I'll split it into half a dozen lemmas. So the first thing which we want to show is that this function phi is...
Do you think this is a good time to have a break?
No, it's up to you. It's
about an hour and
a half
before you begin.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's for you to decide. It's a reasonable time for the break, yes.
Okay, yeah. Well, why don't we have a break and then we can leave up that sign.
Yeah, okay. Let me maybe just...
So, everyone will have 5 minutes to absorb this.
Okay. Let's go on for 3 more minutes. I'll show the next slide, which has the plan of the proof. And okay.
So, you should...
Okay.
Why this is going to ultimately be what you want for the easing model.
Okay, so first of all, I will say, maybe I'll show a couple of slides which sort of go informally through the proof, and then we'll go formally, but it's not all that difficult. So what we do, we take this function f of z, which has a purely combinatorial definition, and by some sort of local rearrangements of our configurations, we'll show that f is indeed prehomomorphic with the usual definition, or actually with a slightly unusual definition,
which we are
here on a square lattice, but the proof, it works on any valency 4 lattice, apart from some a priori estimates because you need some sort of estimates which show that the total thing that this thing doesn't go completely haywire, doesn't blow up, and for that you need some sort of estimates to start with, like that magnetization is zero for Ising model, and it's well known for square lattice, and they have an Zager unpublished manuscript or Young's published manuscript, and that one can do if you do a different lattice of valency 4, then one has to reproduce this, but otherwise it is okay.
Remind me, prehomomorphic is the same as discrete analytic.
Discrete analytic, yeah. Well, I have an objection to the term discrete analytic, because analytic means that it has a power series expansion. Discrete analytic functions don't have a discrete power series expansion. So there are 4 different words which used to be used for analytic functions. So for example, regular or holomorphic or analytic, and they imply different definitions. So holomorphic function is basically function which has a complex derivative. Regular function is a regular function. Holomorphic function is a function whose contour intervals are zero. So these two definitions work very well in discrete case. Analytic function is a function which has a power series expansion. There are no power series expansion. There are no Taylor formula in discrete case. But historically, discrete analytic is more widely used. Though original people who did this, they used the term holomorphic, pre-holomorphic.
This is pre-holomorphic?
No, pre-holomorphic is just that it's holomorphic on the lattice. Yeah, well, usually they call it holomorphic. Okay, we can call it delta holomorphic, where delta is the mesh of the lattice, so anything. But I have some objection to the term analytic. But it's not analytic.
I almost have forgotten the etymology of analytic and holomorphic.
Well, I mean, 50 years ago they were not meaning the same thing.
Yeah, okay.
No, but if you open a paper by Hardy or Littlewood from 30s, they make a clear distinction, because sometimes they know, of course they perfectly know that all the definitions are equivalent, but they use the word which is for the definition they use in that paper.
Well, in fact, so, we still have real analytic, which is a real function that's kind of
parallel. Yes, yeah. So real analytic is different, yeah.
But probably discrete Hall work is probably better.
No, now I think the only thing which is left, distinction that physicist mathematicians and applied mathematicians use different words. It's like with the Fourier series, we use different normalization for Fourier transforms with a 2 pi 1 or square root of 2 pi, but never mind. So the second thing is we have to figure out the boundary conditions, and it turns out that the boundary condition is what is written here. And the reason is that our function is written in terms of the winding of this interface. And if we have a point inside, we can go through this point like that, or we can have a full turn beforehand. But if we have point on the boundary, there is only one direction from which we can approach. So for any given point on the boundary, the winding is easy to calculate. And it turns out that this is the boundary value problem, because the winding will be the same for our interface or for tangent or for the boundary curve. And it turns out that this is the boundary value problem. And it is solved in the continuum case by the map to a strip, by derivative of the map to a strip, because derivative of map to a strip is certainly analytic, homomorphic or regular or whole, and if you take it to the power sigma, it will have this property.
Sir, it looks like in this red lines,
yeah,
take this sort of power one over sigma.
Yes.
First, is it possible to do with im in front of this line? It's obvious that the imaginary part of power.
Ah, okay. I okay, I screwed it up a little bit here. Let me. Well, you see, the thing is that we are working with a discrete case where it's not all at all well defined. So in the continuum case, not exactly. So it's more. You should. not exactly. Yeah. But anyway, we are not. You cannot really write this or that in discrete case. It's sort of some form or some discretization of that. Of that, yes, that's you are right, of course, yeah, that's. But it's a bit of cheating that I write this formula anyway.
Would this be easier if omega happened to be a rectangle in the right direction?
If omega is a rectangle, it's much easier because in any given place you have Dirichlet-Neumann problem.
Right.
So it's much easier. So there is no problem that you can pass to the limit in that case. So if you want to use this to calculate spin pair correlations in half plane, then one. Well, I think Rick Kenyon could have done this, like, well, I don't know, 5 years ago, certainly. I don't know why he never did it, but it's not a problem, no. What we need to show that this function f, it converges to its continuum counterpart. So it turns out that it converges uniformly. It's much stronger than what we need. We need some sort of weak convergence to pass to the interfaces. But there is a uniform convergence, and what we do to prove it, we actually do, we do exactly, we integrate this thing, since imaginary part of something is zero along the boundary, then if we integrate, the imaginary part of integral is constant on the boundary. So the imaginary part of this integral, it solves the Dirichlet boundary value problem, and it's an imaginary part of the map to a strip, so it solves the problem that one on the upper arc and zero on the lower arc. And that's what one has to work with. But there is one slight problem, that we have to write down a square of a discrete homomorphic function. And square of discrete homomorphic function is no longer discrete homomorphic. So you cannot integrate it. It doesn't have a unique integral along a path. Integral depends on the path. But there is a small miracle, which it so happens that for imaginary part, the integral is independent of a path, and we can do that. It's not true for the usual definition of prehomomorphic function, but for the definition we use, we have slightly different variation. It is true, and the result is not harmonic or analytic, but it's approximately harmonic and solves the Dirichlet boundary value problem, and that's what allows to pass to a limit. I don't know whether I should say a few words why it is enough to show that interface is a CLE. Should I say it now or should I say it later? Or should we have a break?
Well, you should put up that theorem.
The previous one or the theorem with the CLE? This one?
Yes.
Okay. And you can meditate. Yeah.
And then everyone can have 5 minutes to thoroughly absorb the statement.
Okay.
And then...
Okay, very good. Yeah, but then if time permitting, I can say why this theorem is enough to actually get the wall of the interface. Or, well, everything.
That f passes through a point in different directions and you have different waves. So actually, if z is a vertex, indeed there are these possibilities. But if you take z in the middle of an h, you cannot have a middle possibility. If this is possible, then the second one is not possible. So why so? Suppose that we have a point z somewhere here. If I draw a picture, for example, picture like this, and interface starts from this point, then what happens with interface? Interface, it turns 90 degrees at every vertex.
So the interface is on the medial lattice?
Now we forget the original lattice. We have this loop model on the lattice, and that's the only lattice I have speak of. So this is the lattice. So interface, it turns 90 degrees at every point. So if you cover your lattice in chessboard covering, then one cover is always on the right, say black cover is always on the right. So if you pass through this point in some configuration right to left, then in every configuration you pass right to left. You cannot pass it left to right. So if you pass it in this configuration with 0 degree turn, then in other configurations what you can have is only some multiple of 360 degrees. And multiple of 360 degrees gives you weight of plus minus 1. So if for one configuration here you have real weight, you always have real weight. So basically the argument of f is always defined up to plus minus multiple of 180 degrees. So f of z is always parallel, so if here it, for example, is real, so it's proportional to 1, so it's some real number, then here you turn to the right, and what you get that here it will be proportional always to the real number times square root of I. Here it will proportion to real number times I. Here, real number times another square root of I. And this will go in chessboard. Maybe it's better if I picture the argument of F. So it might be more comfortable. So the argument of F will be 0 plus pi or plus pi k. So here it will be pi over 2, pi over 4. So here it will be pi over 2. And here will be minus pi over 4. So argument up to pi. And then it goes in chessboard covering. I might have screwed up the sign, I'll just get the anti-analytic function there. Let me see. Is it 0? 0, 0, 5. Yeah, I screwed up the sign, of course. Okay. So this is the argument of f. So for example, if we just look at f on the edges, then on each edge we have basically one real number. So here we have real number, here we have imaginary number, here we have number in this argument. So each edge returns one real number, not one complex number, but one real number. Then the second lemma, and that's the sort of a form of real analyticity which we will use. Maybe I'll formulate it with a slight overview. So suppose we have a vertex. So how can our interface approach this vertex? Well, it can approach from edge and then it turns. So I will just smoothen out these turns. And let me sample f, function f, at these four points. Then if we had this argument right here, 0, pi over 4, pi over 2, then here argument changes by half of that. So it's the argument would be, well, if for example here it was 0 and it was pi over 4, it was pi over 2 and minus pi over 4, then it will be twice the less pi over 8, 3 pi over 8, minus pi over 8, minus pi over 8. So it turns out that if we sample f at those 4 points, or at those 8 points, then actually we don't get at those 4 points 4 independent. Let's get values of f of z at these 4 points.
Okay, in what sense? It's a function defined.
It's a function. It's defined at those 4 points.
It's not defined there. It's defined on all the points on the lattice, right?
Yeah, but this is our curve. You see, it's smooth as a little bit. So here it's probability that you pass through this turn. It's just sort of to uncouple different passages through.
These points correspond to the same point in the original lattice, right?
So they correspond to the same point, but
one value of this function.
No, it's adjusting.
I want to distinguish this passage.
The winding angle is different depending on how you go through.
It's just interpolating the obvious thing.
Yes. So there are 4 ways to pass through this vertex, and I distinguish them. It's slightly easier. You can actually work only with edges, and then it's much clearer what to do. But then it works very nice for what I'm going to prove. But it doesn't work for other lattices.
So just to be clear, on the top, that's the argument modulo pi.
Argument modulo pi. Yeah. Okay. So now let us check what happens. With f when you pass through this point. So what I claim is that values of f at those 4 points, let's label them northeast, northwest, and southwest and southeast, so that the values of f at those 4 points are projections of one complex number on 4 lines which go at 45 degrees. So those are projections of f on 4 lines which go like that. So there is one number which we can denote by f of z, and the value of f at those 4 points, they're just projections of this number on these 4 lines. So this is f northeast, f northwest, etc. So meaning that instead of 4 real numbers, we actually have only 2 real numbers. So we only have one complex number, and so there is an interrelation between these 4 numbers. So why there is an interrelation between these 4 numbers? So to prove that indeed you have this relation, it's enough to show that f of northeast plus f of southwest is equal to f of northwest plus f of southeast. Why? Because we know the arguments of those things. We know that, for example, f northeast and f southwest, they have certain arguments which differ by 90 degrees. So those two, they actually belong to 2 lines which are orthogonal. And those two belong to 2 different lines which are orthogonal. So those two belong to those 2 lines. So if we show that these two belong to 2 orthogonal lines and their sum is the same of sum of 2 other numbers which belong to 2 different orthogonal lines, it just means that those two are orthogonal decompositions of the same vector. So it's enough to check this linear relation to show that these two things are coordinates of one vector in this coordinate system, and that those two are coordinates in the Yoke coordinate system. It's enough to check that. Is it okay? So this linear relation actually would imply a slightly stronger statement. And to check this linear relation, we first check what is the contribution of some configuration to this linear relation. So of course, if we take some configuration, it can happen that it contributes, say, 1 to the left side and 0 to the right side. But we do local rearrangement at this point. So let's denote this point x. And what we do, we change how the cycles are connected at this point x. And there are 2 possibilities. Either our interface doesn't pass through x.
So let me just...
Oh, of course.
Okay.
So you're going to have, at every vertex, you will now have four numbers.
Yes, at every, but actually there are only two. Yes, yeah, yeah.
And, but this is, so all of those four numbers are just determined
by two numbers, yeah.
By this F,
yeah.
Z.
Yeah. This. Yeah. Okay. And the reason is this, we have two possible pictures. So if our interface passes through Z, when we make this rearrangement, there are two configurations. In one configuration, it passes through Z twice. If we make rearrangement, then it will pass once, but there will be an additional loop. So if the weight of the configuration on the left is X, then the weight of configuration on the right is X times square root of 2, because there is one additional loop. So in easing model, it's square root of 2. In other models, it would be square root of Q. So the weight, if this weight is X, then this weight is X times square root of 2. Now let's check what are the contributions to this relation of left and right configuration. So the configuration on the right, our interface only passes through one point, southwest. And assume that here the phase is, well, zero. So here that here really this complex weight is 1. But we just include it into X. So the contribution of this picture is X times square root of 2. Then what happens with the picture on the left? In the picture on the left, we pass through northwest and southeast, so we only contribute something here, nothing there. And the total weight of configuration would be X times a difference in the complex weight. What is the difference in the complex weight between this picture and that picture? Well, if in this picture, when we went from B to this point, well, like here, we turned left by 45 degrees, then here we turned right by 45 degrees. So the difference in winding is 90 degrees. So the difference would be this complex weight for 90 degrees. So if weight per pi over 2 turn is this, then here the weight at this point will be X times lambda. And at that point, you can just calculate the winding. It will be minus 90 degrees, so we will have this sort of input. So this is just a simple combinatorial consideration. So if you take these two configurations, then the weight in them is the same up to two things. Complex weight is different because there is different winding when we reach different points. And also configuration on the right has one additional loop, which generates the square root of 2. So the configuration on the right will only contribute to F of at southwest, whereas the other two, F at northwest and F at southeast. So two configurations together, they will contribute to the left side of this relation, X times lambda plus X times lambda bar, and to the right side, X times square root of 2. And this is an identity, because on the right we have square root of 2, on the left we have lambda plus lambda bar, and lambda being that number, lambda plus lambda bar is twice cosine of 45 degrees, so exactly square root of 2.
So right, yes. For this part, nothing here, you haven't said anything about the edge weights being critical. That's not really
Because the edge weights on the medial lattice, they're not present anymore. They were edge weights on the original spin lattice.
Okay,
so if here, what happens if we introduce here edge weights? Then we have to check whether those two points belong to the lattice, to the spin lattice, or dual spin lattice. Depending on that, we'll either have weight 1 here and P over 1 minus P on the right, or vice versa. So we still get some relation. It's still a holomorphic relation, and one can still run the whole machinery, but if one just runs it as here, you get a trivial limit. You get a function which has limits identically zero. What you can do, you can tend temperature to critical, and as you tend mesh accordingly, and then you get non-trivial things and interesting things. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. You get some sort of skewed holomorphic relation, which, if you skew a function, is just a holomorphic relation.
So, because we're at criticality, this doesn't change the weights.
No, if we are not in criticality, the weights will change. There will be slightly different weights. But one have to write slightly different definition of our function then. Because here one can say in some sense that this sum is f of z, f at f of x, f at this point, and if you have non-critical, then you have to put some coefficients in front of that, like p of 1 minus p, but it perfectly works.
I
because of criticality,
because it's critical, we can consider we're just weighted by the number of loops.
Yeah, so if we are off criticality, then the scaling limit of an interface will be trivial. It will be just pushed to one side of the boundary. So scaling limit of the same observer would be trivial. But you can take a limit where critical temperature tends to critical one according, well, in some coordination with the mesh,
and then you get a trivial limit.
The way you're using criticality is the fact that we're weighted by the number of loops.
Yes, yeah, and there is nothing else. So I don't know. So is it clear why you have this relation? Yeah. Okay. But then one can also get the very same relation if one samples function at the edge centers, only the calculation is slightly more difficult because then you write something like lambda. Well, there are more inputs in this case, and you have to check a more relation which is more complicated, not immediately clear. But because here there are, this thing contributes to 2 points, that contributes to 4, and you get a relation of that sort, so you have to check some degree 3 polynomial of lambda being equal to something. So it's slightly more difficult. Okay, so maybe that's enough of the pictures. Where is off button? Ah, okay. So what we now do, we will start working with that. And I want, it's possible to see that from this a usual discrete homomorphic relation follows. But I won't use it, so I won't spend time showing that it follows. Instead, I will directly pass to the proof, to the limit. And the way we do that...
hold on, so what exactly have you proved at this point?
At this point, we have proved that if we take values of f at those 4 points, or if we take values of f at these 4 edges, those are just projections of the same number on 8 different lines. So 4 lines in that case and 4 different lines in this case. So it's this sort of funny picture.
And where you get the relation is the fact that the things on edges also are the things.
Yeah. This relation is enough because, it's sort of the usual statement. If A is real and B is imaginary and A plus B is equal to Z, then A and B are coordinates of Z. So we use this for four coordinate systems. Okay. Now, what we do, the next lemma, which is just the definition of the function H. So let's define function H of Z. So H of V is defined on faces of our lattice by the following relation. So if we have 2 faces and one of them is always black and one is white, if we have 2 faces, and then there are, let's say, U and V, then we set H of V minus H of U equal to F of this H, F on this H, absolute value squared.
So, let me just understand this a little bit more.
Yeah.
So this property, you're saying, is stronger than pre-homomorphic.
Yeah. Well, it's basically, it's not stronger. It's a pre-homomorphic property where two halves of the functions are interrelated. It's very easy to check that if, for example, if you look at f only on horizontal edges, so it means that you only look at f at points like this, then it's the usual homomorphic property. But with one addition, that real and imaginary, well, here it's sort of, since f is always real here and imaginary here, then it's the usual homomorphic property. Yes, yeah. So on the horizontal edges, it's just the usual homomorphic property. If you look at the vertices, it's the usual homomorphic property plus some interrelation between 2 halves of the function.
I don't see how you get any information from...
But it's not... It's
no, from this... So what you told... The statement is that if you take f of z,
So now you, for every z, you have 8 separate.
Ah, okay. You ask why different vertices are related.
Well,
is that your question?
Via this northwest, northeast, they're related.
We're edges. They are related. Yes. Yeah.
So for these northwest, northeast, south, and southeast, you don't really need those for.
Well, you don't. The thing which actually happens is that if you want to do different lattices, then you the function on h you define at this point not as the h function, but rather as the sum of those two. It's basically the same, but there is a slight change in the weight. So it's that sort of thing.
And how is that related to another vertex?
Oh, because. Well, it's basically the same thing that if you have an interface which passes through this, it's forced to pass through that. It's only difference in weight. Yeah, but it's not important for our proof. You ask questions. Well, it's better to ask this question afterward. So for our proof, it's not important. So for our proof, So this is the definition of function h. So function h, in some sense, so the remark is that the function h is imaginary part of the integral of f squared. And the reason why this function h is that is that you can check that, it's sort of f, we know what is the argument of f on edges of different direction, and if you check exactly what are the increments of h, it will boil down to that formula. But that's
not. F squared is really pointwise multiplication?
No, it's in continuum that corresponds to that. In continuum limit. Here it's this sort of funny form, because you see on this edge we only have either real part of f or imaginary part of f, so it's not really square of f. It's either square of its real part or square of its imaginary part. Okay, so the third lemma is that h is well defined. So to check that h is well defined, we need to check that if we take two integrals from a to b, they will yield the same result. So we need to check that if we go around some contour, then integral of this thing is equal to zero. So essentially we need to check that, so maybe I'll draw a proof here, we need to check that that if we go around this point, then the sum of the increments of h, that the sum of delta h is equal to zero when we go around some vertex, and that would be enough for h to be well defined. Well, up to a constant we fix it to be zero somewhere. Okay, now what is the sum of these increments? Well, there are two black squares and two white squares. And let me denote those edges by, I don't know, A, B, C, and D. So this sum is F of A squared, because we go into the black edge, so we increase. Into black square, we increase. Then we go out of black square, so we decrease by this definition. So it's minus F of B squared plus F of C squared minus f of d squared. Okay? It's just by definition, because our function always, when we go from white to black, is increasing, and from black to white is decreasing. So in some sense we have two functions, one on black faces, one on white faces, and the black function is bigger than white function. But what turns out that when we go around, this sums to zero. And why does this sum to zero? Because there are two terms. There is a positive term, f of a squared plus f of c squared. And a negative term, f of b squared plus f of d squared. And you remember that f of a, b, c, and d, they are projections of the same number on four lines. So when we take projection of one number on two orthogonal lines which correspond to A and C, and we sum the squares, by Pythagoras' theorem, we get just the square of our number. And here, by Pythagoras' theorem, it's also the square of our number. So those two things are the same by Pythagoras' theorem. Okay? Because both of those are just this F of Z. So it's Okay, I'm not sure whether it's visible when I write here. F of z squared minus f of z squared. Okay?
So I don't need to use the definition of that f e squared is the difference of the ages.
So this is the definition of age. And lemma 3 says that it's a well, it's a well defined thing.
But the non-trivial thing seems to be their remark that H is the emergent part.
But we won't use it.
Oh, you're not going to use that.
No, I'm not going to use it.
Because that's not the modulus of F squared.
No.
F squared.
Yeah. No, it's one can check because you see the thing is that when we go from white to black, we always increase, and we go from black to white, we decrease. So to really get this, we need to make two steps like that,
right.
And then together they will give what is they will give instead exactly this, because you write like real part squared minus imaginary part squared, and that will be it.
But the main thing is that H is well defined.
Yeah,
definition.
Yeah. The main thing is that H is well defined. Okay, now there is a lemma 4. Which says that, let's say, supremum of H on black vertices minus H on white vertices tends to zero as mesh goes to zero. So I mean on two neighboring black and white vertices. So if maybe it's better to write it like that. So if a sample H at one black vertice and one white vertice, and we take the difference, then the difference tends to zero when mesh goes to zero.
The difference itself doesn't go to zero? They need the
supremum. Well, it's supremum for, yeah, the difference goes to zero, yeah. For.
What's the meaning of this?
The maximum difference over the whole domain tends to zero. Because what happens is that if we take this whole domain omega, there are these two functions. There is function h on black vertices, there is function h on white vertices. But the difference between them tends to zero.
So the supremum is over the whole...
Over the whole domain,
yeah.
Oh, sorry, yeah. It's sort of... This is the only place where you have to use some knowledge in the first theorem when you prove convergence to SLE you need to use more, but this is the only place in the theorem about observable where you have to use some knowledge about the Ising model, and the proof goes like that.
It's a simple basic question. Everything up here is, as you covered, for example,
yes,
specific to the Ising model, right?
Yes. Yes. If it's not, if you try to mimic the same thing with arbitrary value of Q, then what happens is that you get, instead of 100% of Cauchy-Riemann relations, you get 75% of Cauchy-Riemann relations. Well, I mean, if you do it in straightforward way, you get 50%, which is not, which is completely senseless, useless, because Cauchy-Riemann relations, basically there are two relations, that divergence is zero and curl is zero. If you just know that curl is zero, it means that your function is gradient of something. And our function is, by definition, gradient of something. It's so that's useless. But you actually get 75%. You get also half of the other things. And maybe if one does it in a very smart way, 75 can be pushed to 100. I don't know. So it's...
Yeah, but what is special about Q equals 2 is that it's definite phase or up to a sign, it has a definite phase.
Well, there is an interesting thing, because there is another observable which has a definite phase for every model, but there again there is this 75% problem, but... that we can discuss afterwards. And the interesting thing is that 75% is not empty, because for OFN model, if you do it with arbitrary x, you get 50% of Cauchy-Riemann relations. But if you take x to be equal to Niehaus predicted number, you get 75%. And that sort of explains why Niehaus prediction should be correct. Because as far as I understand, even physics people don't understand it very well. So it's sort of...
I don't understand what good 75% of Cauchy-Riemann relations
is. Oh, it's better than 50. Strictly bigger by 25. I mean... Okay. No, Well, maybe one can get something out of it, I don't know. Okay, so how the proof of that works? So what is the HB minus h w. Well, it's f of this h. And f of this h is strictly smaller than the probability that this h belongs to the interface, because it's this probability taken with some sign, so there might be some constellations. And probability that h passes through a point tends to zero in the limit, because magnetization is zero. So this basically is at most it's a very crude estimate. It's actually much smaller than that, but it's smaller than mesh of the lattice to the power 1 over 8. It's just by Kaufmann and Zager, Young. It's an interesting question. I try to research the literature. It seems that the answer is yes and no. It might be that people just didn't push a little bit, because there are different things, like there is Burton-Kinn, which I know different paper of Burton-Kinn was mentioned yesterday. So there are some methods. It's not rigorously written anywhere, but it might be that people like almost know it. I think what happens is that for q bigger or equal than 1, probably one can make a proof out of existing literature, but I'm not exactly sure.
But this is just the dimension of this cube?
Oh yeah, but we're talking about rigorous mathematical statements.
Yeah, yeah.
Does the magnetization of the particle vanish?
No, physically it's clear that magnetization is zero. Yeah, it's like 100% clear, but yeah. Mathematically I'm not so sure. Well, the thing is that what happens that we have this A and B points, and we have this interface. So of course, in small neighborhood of A or small neighborhood of B, this probability is much higher, because if there is some bottleneck here, then the probability grows up. But out of this neighborhood, there is a uniform estimate. Yeah.
So the soup is out of that neighborhood?
Yes, yeah, omega minus neighborhood of AB. Well, okay, sure, of course, because here there will be a jump, we'll see in a second. Okay, so that's the only piece of literature we need, and we don't need 1 over 8, we just need something tending to 0. And but 1 over 8 is basically Kaufmann on Zager's unpublished fourth paper, or Young's paper.
It's for the discrete finite lattice, right?
And yes, yeah. Well, I mean, strictly speaking, what they did, they did this for a square with all plus boundary conditions, but then there is enough technique we know to just transfer it to anything. It's not that difficult.
But just to make it rigorous, that means for every epsilon, you did a fixed epsilon, how far away from A and B
do we have to be? Well, but for us, we'll need this observable only like in some definite part inside of the domain.
When
so it's yeah.
The domain.
Yeah, we're looking
okay.
Inside because SLE in finite time won't reach won't leave some sort of area like that.
Okay.
And we're just working with the if you are about SLE convergence, and if for about the theorem which is of independent interest, then it's just outside those two neighborhoods. But when one can also send these neighborhoods to zero as a mesh goes to zero, because you see there is this estimate. So it's okay. So the fifth lemma is there are two parts in the proof which I'm not quite happy with. So this is the lemma which I know how to prove, but I'm very unhappy with the proof. So it says that if we take of course, since we were integrating f squared, it's a miracle that there is an integral, and of course the integral is not analytic. But it turns out that if we restrict h to black squares, then it's superharmonic, and if we restrict h to white squares, it's subharmonic. Okay, so first of all, I want to say that there is no contradiction here, because there is anti-symmetry between black and white squares. When you go from white to black, h is increasing. So if you want to interchange white and black, you have to speak not of h, but of 1 minus h, 1 minus h. And so, of course, subharmonic becomes superharmonic and vice versa. Now, the proof...
The discrete Laplacian is now defined only on the black squares.
Yeah, so the discrete Laplacian, maybe I'll draw a picture. So if this is a black square, so the discrete Laplacian is defined like that. You take all the black neighbors and you subtract the black center. So you take all the black neighbors, B1, B2, B3, B4, and you subtract the center. So how does the proof goes? Well, first of all, you observe that actually if you know values of F at those two points, then you can calculate this thing. Why can you calculate this thing? So if you know value of F at this yellow point, then values at these edges are projections of F on four different lines. If you know value of F here, values at these four edges are projections on these four lines. Now you can get value of F here because you know two projections on two different lines. They are not at 90 degrees, they are at 45 degrees, so it's a very complicated formula. So you know F here, so you know it at these points. And you know F here, you know it at these points. And then of course you can get the difference because you go over this edge and then over that edge. So just by knowing F at those two points, let me denote them by U and V, you can calculate this Laplacian. And it turns out that you calculate it, well, you spend like one full day and first two times you get the wrong result, but the answer is that delta H at this point B is exactly F of U minus F of V squared. So I don't have a satisfactory proof of that. So I have a proof which is a two-page calculation, and or maybe it's up to multiplicative constants. It's sometimes I get multiplicative constants, sometimes I don't.
It's a random factor.
It's a random. Well, it's a time dependent. It's always super harmonic, but with a time dependent factor. It's not really important whether we get the same sign or not. It's important that we get some sign. No, I have a because for the other case it will be the opposite. No, I have some hand waving argument which says that because of the symmetries of the lattice, it should be a quadratic form, which should be this time some constant. And then of course, if constant is zero, we have harmonic function. If constant is positive, we have this situation. If it's negative, we have the opposite. So there is some hand waving, but it's not. I don't know. I think there should be an easier proof. And if you want, I can show you the calculations. They are not very difficult, and it's sort of okay.
So this is still just discrete combinatory,
Yeah, it's a discrete. There is not. Well, there is in the whole proof. There is nothing except for this. So if you want to do this with these boundary conditions, you have to use FKG and all that. But I mean, that's the only place where we use something not trivial. It's a trivial proof. Yeah, but it's
elementary
proof. Okay. Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay, that is. No, but it only makes me happier. But. Okay, so the lemma 6, we have a function H now, which is integral of F, which is supposed to solve Dirichlet boundary value problem. We're basically almost there because we have sup and super harmonic functions, which have very small difference. So basically, there is a harmonic function in between. So we only have to figure out the boundary values. And the That is taken care of by lemma 6, which says that if we take A and B, then on the arc A, H is identically equal to 1, and on the other arc, H is identically equal to 0.
So
that H solve this Dirichlet boundary value on this piece of the boundary, it's exactly equal to 1. This H. No. It's the discrete H exactly is equal to 1 or 0. So okay. Let me just draw slightly better picture. So I would draw a picture like this. So that's an example of an allowed domain. So what I mean that on these black squares, on all of these black squares, H is equal to 1, and all that white squares, which are on the boundary, H is equal to 0. And there is a jump over this source A or sink B.
So you always have white squares on the boundary?
Yes. On one arc there are always black squares, on the other arc there are always white squares.
So that you're restricting your boundary to?
No, but that's automatic because of this loop model. When you draw it, it's that's because.
Where was the original lattice?
The original lattice is either white squares or black squares.
It's wired by
conditions. With so the original lattice it goes like that. So there is a blue lattice which goes here, and there are wired boundary conditions, and because of that our loop bounces off.
Yeah.
And there are two wired boundary conditions here, and our loop bounces off on the other side. So it has to go from A to B.
Then that will still have that same property.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we draw this curve, it still has all this property. Yeah. Oh, okay. It's I mean, for those who know, there is this model which is called double dimer, where Rick Kenyon can get some discrete homomorphic things, and there the problem is that he can get it only for domains with some local boundary property like this. But once you start drawing interfaces, the domain no longer satisfies this property. Here it's not the case. It's all the domains you get when you draw the interface, they automatically have this property. Okay, so the proof is quite easy. So first I show that H is constant on this arc, and I mean that's very easy. So actually, if I write here, is it visible? Or, yeah. Okay. So for example, let's just compare. So this is the boundary of our domain, and we compare. So these are two points. Let's say U, V, and W. So what is H of W minus H of U? Well, there is this increment plus that increment. In one case we go down, in the other case we go up. So these two edges, we denote them by E and F. So this is basically F of F squared minus F of E squared. Because here we go into white, here we go out of white. So this is the difference of those two things. But those two things, they have different argument, but they have the same modulus. And the reason why they have the same modulus is that if interface passes through this edge, it has no way out. It has to turn in and pass through that edge. So those two things, they have the same modulus. And another reason is that for a point inside, you can pass through H either in one direction or in the same direction with a 360-degree twist, and that gives weight 1 or minus 1. Here, if you pass through this H, you always pass with the same twist. So it always gives you the same argument, so it always in one direction. So essentially, this thing, F of V, is just absolute value, is probability that this H belongs to the interface. Because sine disappears. Sine is always the same, so with absolute value disappears. And this is probability that HE belongs to the interface, so the sine has disappeared. And those two probabilities are the same. Is it okay? So this just shows you that H is constant here and there. So it's zero below because we just fix it to be zero here. Why it's one here? Because if we look at... If we look at the beginning of this domain, point B, so let's look at these two points, U and V. So H of V minus H of U, but the very same argument. It's just the probability that B belongs to the interface. But this probability is 1, because interface just starts here. So indeed it's 0 and 1. Okay. So what is the conclusion?
So this looks like a Dirichlet boundary problem.
Yeah, that's the Dirichlet boundary problem.
And that is Riemann-Hilbert somehow, but the square root and something.
Yes, because it's the appropriate thing. It's because I had this on the slide because basically what happens is that the problem for F was that F on the boundaries was always parallel to 1 over square root of the tangent vector. That was problem for F. So F squared was parallel to 1 over the tangent vector. So F squared times dz along the boundary, dz was parallel to the real line. So imaginary part of this was constant. And that's basically what we are doing, only it's sort of behind the scenes. This was John's question, that it's non-trivial observation, but we don't need it for the proof. We need it to understand what is going on, but we don't need it for the proof. So what is the conclusion? The conclusion is the following, that there are two functions, hb and hy, such that the difference tends to zero. Hb is superharmonic, hy is subharmonic, or vice versa. And they solve hby is equal to 1, well, 1 on ab, and the other one is equal to 0 on ba, on two arcs. And then, of course, well, if you have two functions which are subharmonic and superharmonic with the same boundary conditions and close to each other, there is a harmonic function in between, and since this gap goes to zero, they have the same limit as this harmonic function. So it means that both of those functions, hb or hy, they converge uniformly inside the domain away from a and b to function h, which is delta h equals 0, and h is equal to 1, h equal to 0 on the boundary arcs.
So it's true on the lattice that when you have this property that there is always a harmonic function in between?
But that's we don't even actually need that. It's sort of... yeah, but maybe the shortest proof, the easiest to explain is with this, because
if
they have these boundary values, actually, because one is for one of the function, another for another. The functions are epsilon closed, so we can push them epsilon apart, so they both have the same boundary values up to epsilon, and one is strictly bigger than another. Then if we do the same boundary values and solve it for harmonic function, it will be in between. But they are very close. So they are very close to the function which solves that. Yeah, so it's... that's probably the easiest hand-waving argument. So we actually established that h has a limit. So now the question is the following. What is this limit? This limit is actually imaginary part of the mapping to a strip. Because this thing, which is 1 above and 0 below, is just the imaginary part of this map phi to a strip. Because it's 1 here and 0 here, so it's 1 strip. So the question is, what did we write there? We wrote basically that h is integral of f squared, meaning that f is h gradient of h square root of gradient of h. Well, h is imaginary part of that. If you take h plus I h tilde, then this. So it's something like this. So we want to so basically, well, that means that f should converge to square root of phi prime. So that's the conclusion. And the question is how to deduce from the fact that h converges the fact that square root of its derivative converges uniformly. And the problem is that, if function converges uniformly, its derivative doesn't converge uniformly. It may be that locally derivative is very large, so there is some sort of a corner. So if our functions are all analytic, if we forget about this small problem that they are approximately analytic, it's very easy, because for analytic functions we have that derivative has integral representation as integral domain, so just Cauchy integral or something. And the integrals, they converge because there is a uniform convergence. So if in a sort of ideal world, what we would use that, so the derivative of h can be written as integral of h over with some weight, or let's say h convolution with something, so with appropriate weight, and this converges to the same thing for h small, which is phi prime. So that would be an ideal world if everything is analytic, because you can write derivative as an integral of something. Now in our case, it's and of course if there is this convergence, then square root of h prime would converge to square root of phi prime. So you have to use here also that sort of things are sufficiently smooth. So if you fix choice of square root in one place, it will be the same both for left and right hand sides all over the domain. So in the usual case, what we have to do, we have to write the following thing. We know that H converges uniformly to H small. Now there is the mean value property for harmonic functions, which says that H is equal to H convolution with some measure, let's say mu, so it's just average over some sides, if H is harmonic. If H is not harmonic, then there is, it's called so-called Ries representation theorem, there is also Laplacian of H convolution with some other measure nu. So one can write it in the continuum. It depends. Well, there are different choices for what you put mu and nu here. So usually, what you have in the continuum case, you have here a logarithm of absolute value of z. In discrete case, you have some discretization of that. So if you have an arbitrary function h, then h has mean value property up to this term. Now this converges uniformly to H, which is harmonic, so it has mean value property. So the conclusion is that this term converges to zero. So the conclusion is that Laplacian of H converges to zero in some weak sense. Its convolution with the logarithm converges to zero. So Laplacian of H converges to zero. For example, in L1 it converges to zero, it converges weakly. Well, okay. Now there is, we want to write the very same thing for.
When you're writing Laplacian here, you talk to me the limit of the continuous
Laplacian. No, I write that I write discrete Laplacian and Laplacian, and here I write discrete version of this kernel. I just.
But is that really? I mean, I understand that equation up there, so I can write it probabilistically.
Yeah.
But you're saying that you get that the Laplacian of H goes to zero just because...
Ah, because look, it is positive. If we do it on the black squares, it is positive.
Okay.
We just do it on black squares. It is positive, and its convolution with some kernel converges to zero with some positive kernel.
In L1,
we have, yeah. Okay. Now we do exactly the same thing, but not for H. We do this thing for the original thing F. Or rather, we do it for f squared. So we write that f squared is f squared convolution with some measure, well, mu, whatever, plus, so if f would be analytic, then would be mean value property. If it's not analytic, then we have another term, which would be d bar of f squared, convolution with some kernel, so usually it's the Cauchy kernel, so it's 1 over z. And then what happens is that this converges all right, because we know that so this can be written as a integral of f squared convolution with some other measure mu prime. So instead of writing, say, average of f squared over bow, it's more or less average of integrals of f over sort of a cross sections over bow. So this can be written in terms of h. So this is h convolution mu prime. So this converges okay. So this converges to what it should converge to. And then there is a problem with this guy. And with this guy, the trick is that actually d bar of f squared and Laplacian of h is the same thing. So one can check that basically it's the on discrete level, it's the same thing. Well, up to a factor of 4. And so this is the same as Laplacian of h. And then this converges in L1. So what we get from that, we don't get convergence of f squared yet, but at least, for example, we get that in L1 it converges. So in particular, the L1 norm of f squared is bounded. Or the same thing, L2 norm of f is bounded. And then we can just invoke classical machinery of discrete analytic functions, so that dates back 50 years to Leland-Ferrand, which says that if L2 norm of analytic functions is bounded, discrete analytic functions is bounded, then it forms a normal family, so there are precompactness results within the domain. So there are uniformly converging subsequences, which also we know converge weakly, so they converge uniformly.
So that's good for an arbitrary
domain?
Yes, that's true for arbitrary domain, yes. Yeah. Well, because this thing will prove inside the domain, and inside domain always we can think that you work with the square. Yeah. So in some sense, from this point on, it's just a purely technical thing, which is not so pleasant, and well, I'm not extremely happy with the way I can do it, but it's probably, it might be the shortest way to do it. But ideologically, it's very easy. Ideologically, you just do that.
So now, as far as what you'll need for the proof of convergence to SLE,
yeah,
I guess you don't really need...
You don't even need uniform convergence.
L1 convergence is enough.
L1 convergence is enough, it's easier to obtain, but it's two steps easier to obtain, yeah.
Okay,
it's just one step easier, so it's not much easier.
Okay.
So weak convergence is even easier, but for SLE. Okay, I think that's it for the proof. So the few things which I didn't have time to talk about, but which I wanted to talk about, are what one does for Fan model and how one deduces convergence to SLE. So if someone is interested, I can just do it some other time.
Is it?
Well, I think it would be important for the average person here to understand why this result implies convergence.
Ah. So I don't know. Isn't it lunchtime? So it's. I can do it now if you're not hungry.
Well, why don't we take a 1 minute break and then.
A hungry people leave for lunch?
After lunch today or after lunch tomorrow? Something like that. Yeah, there's
another talk in this room in 20 minutes.
Oh,
okay. In 20 minutes? They don't go to lunch?
It's a lunch talk.
Ah, it's a lunch talk.
Why don't you just take
10
more minutes and then we'll...
Yeah, okay. So I will then... Let me just... If I have only 10 minutes, then it's easier if I show a slide rather than speak with the blackboard. So sorry for running over time, but this is one of the bad things of spending summer in Russia, because there are the seminar. If you don't run over time, people say that you don't have enough interesting things to say, and you get this bad habit, which then you have to get rid of. Okay.
Your excuse.
Well, that's my excuse. Well, yeah. Well, I didn't really run over time that much, did I? Again, it doesn't come. Yeah, okay. Ah, okay. Ouch. Okay. So what? Orphan model. Okay, we will return to Orphan model. Okay. So I presume everyone knows what Shram-Lovin revolution is by now. There is this differential equation, and this original Shram's principle from his first paper says that if we have a conformally invariant interface which has some Markov property, so that when as we draw it from A to B, it doesn't distinguish its boundary from the domain, then it is one of the SLE processes. And the nice thing which happens is that it's actually true. This principle is true if we just have it for one observable. So if we just want to use this principle, then we have to show that there is scaling limit and it's conformally invariant, and then we calculate some observable to determine k kappa. To show existence for an arbitrary curve that there is a scaling limit to pin down the curve, in principle, we need infinitely many observables. It's not enough to know probability that it passes above one point. It's enough to know the probability it passes above million points for any million points, so to say. But a priori, to use this principle, it seems to be very difficult because you need to really calculate infinitely many observables. But fortunately, if you have this property that when you draw a curve from A to B, it doesn't distinguish its boundary from the domain, and you have conformal invariance, it's enough to calculate just one observable. So essentially, if there is a conformally covariant observable, then we can reconstruct a SLE. So how the proof goes for the easing model, for example? So first of all, we take we fix a mesh, we get a random broken line from A to B. And then for every value of mesh, we get a random broken line from A to B. So we have the collection indexed by mesh of random broken lines. So now we have to use some priori estimates. So here indeed one has to use this some sort of power law in the Kaufmann and Zager Young estimates to get that this collection of meshes is precompact, let's say, in the space of curves with Hölder parameterizations, which can be parameterized by Lovener evolutions. So that a priori estimates I can speak of later, but maybe not now, because that will use more than 10 minutes. And since the collection is precompact in a very strong sense, to show that as mesh goes to zero, it converges to SLE, it's enough to show that if there is a converging subsequence, it converges to SLE. So we, since the collection is precompact in a very strong sense, it's enough to assume that subsequence is converging and then show that limit is SLE. So what we do, we take converging subsequence, we pass to a limit, we get a random curve which is no longer broken line, we map it to half plane and we describe it by Lovener evolution. So Lovener evolution gives for every deterministic curve some driving force, deterministic driving force WT, and for random curve it gives a random driving force WT. So we need to show that this WT is a Brownian motion, and then we would be done. So the property which, so the way we do this, we use our observable to pin down the increments of W and W squared. So how does this work? So first, let's look at our observable F at a point Z. So it's a probability that this curve passes through Z with some sign. Now, there is a total probability formula which says that probability or expectation of some event is equal to expectation of conditional expectation. So, if we run this curve up to time t and stop it there, and we evaluate f for this case, then expectation of these things will be our original f. This is true just by construction of our curve. So the way it goes, let's say, for example, assume that to time t, there were two ways to draw our curve, like this and that, with probability p and 1 minus p. Then what happens? That clearly f of z would be really the same observable when we continue from this point on times p, plus the same observable when we continue from this point on times 1 minus p. So we would just get this formula. So this is just total expectation formula. Okay. Now, F in the discrete case was this discrete solution of the discrete Riemann boundary value problem, and in the limit, so again we have to use a priori estimate, so in the limit when Z is away from the boundary, we have that this converges to the derivative of a map to a strip. Now, what is the map of half plane to a strip? Half plane is mapped to a strip by logarithmic map. So we take log z derivative to the power sigma. So for easing it was power 1 half, I will just do it with arbitrary power. So on the left we have derivative of logarithm is 1 over z to the power sigma is 1 over z to the power sigma. Okay? Okay. Now, what do we have on the right? Well, on the right we have a slightly more complicated domain because it's not half plane anymore. But it's half plane with a slit and it's mapped to half plane by the Lovener map GT. So GT is mapped to half plane, and then logarithm maps it to strip. So our thing is just logarithm GT prime to the power sigma. So it's basically GT prime over GT, something like that. So it's something specific in GT. So we want to extract information about WT. So WT can be extracted from GT by sort of looking at some nonlinear equation, simple but nonlinear. So we get some information about WT, but not a very usable one. So what we do, we use expansion of GT at infinity. So maybe I'll just scroll two sides back. So GT solves this equation and it has that expansion at infinity. And similarly, you can differentiate it to get expansion for GT prime. And this expansion, first three terms, they just have very simple form in terms of W. So when you plug in this expansion for GT at infinity into this formula, you get the first three terms of this expectation. So it's just a simple calculation with Taylor series. You plug in expansion of GT at infinity, so we assume that Z is very large, then you send it to infinity, and you get this formula. So there is, well, I factored out 1 over Z to the power sigma, it's easier, and then there is 1, then there is 1 over Z term, then there is 1 over Z squared term, and then there are smaller terms. So what do we have now? We have a power series on the left, which is a trivial one. We have power series on the right, whose expectation is equal to the series on the left. Then, as formal power series, they should be equal, meaning that these two coefficients, green and blue one, should vanish. Because, here there are things like sigma, sigma plus 1, they are non-zero. So essentially we get that these two coefficients vanish, meaning that the expectation of WT is 0 and expectation of WT squared minus 8T over sigma plus 1 is 0. And we can do this trick if we stop it not at time T as we did, but stop twice at time T and then at time S. And then we get the same formula for increments of W. So we get that there is W of T, which is a random function, which is continuous almost surely, that's by Lovner theorem because it parameterizes a curve, and such that its increments, expectations of increments are zero, and expectations of the increments of the square are proportional to T with some coefficient. So basically we know that this thing and those things are martingales. And then by Levy characterization theorem, if they are local martingales, then we can write that W of T is just Brownian motion with the speed, which is this coefficient in front of T, square root of that. Well, in particular, if you plug in sigma equal to 1/2, we get speed 16 over 3. So the particular speed you get from the particular observable. So the interesting thing about this sort of martingale expansion trick is that first it's sort of error correcting. If you screwed up completely the first part and if you do the first part and you calculate some observable, if it's not conformally invariant, then you know that you don't have a SLE, you deal with something which is not conformally invariant. Suppose you get something conformally invariant. Then you plug it into this method, I will be finished in 2 minutes. There are only very few conformally covariant things for which this would work. So if you plug in something wrong, if you screwed up the computation, then you'll get some contradiction. You'll get some process where the expectation of the square of W of T will be not proportional to T, but say proportional to T to the power of 5, and you understand that you screwed up the computations. And the other nice thing is, for those who don't know much about SLE, that it can be done in reverse to calculate things. So if you want to calculate for SLE this function f of t, you use this martingale property and you do it in reverse. You write this formula and from it you get some equation for f of t, some PD, which allows to reconstruct its values. Yeah, so I think that's basically it.
One thing isn't entirely clear to me. In the earlier part, you proved that something converges into the L1 norm.
Yes.
How do you make contact with what you do?
Because what we do there, you see, we had this formula in the discrete case, and we want to have it for limiting curve. So we need to F to converge here and there. If there is a uniform convergence, it's very easy. If there is convergence in L1 norm, we don't plug in a particular Z, we plug in some average value over some small ball. Okay. So it would be enough, yeah. But then, of course, it looks much nicer, the theorem, if you state a uniform convergence. And so probably it's better to go to some pains to prove it.
Yeah. Maybe. So you didn't do SLE 3, you did 16 over 3.
Yeah, well, that's how one does SLE 3.
So is it the 3?
It's a different observable.
It's a different observable. It's the.
It moved a little bit. Gosh. Well, yeah.
So is the observable match? I guess that's what you're telling.
Yeah, that's it's a different observable. You look at a perimeter which ends at Z. I don't know why it shifted. It was okay yesterday. But it's, computers, whatever.
You need something that ends at Z.
Yeah, you need something that ends at Z. So it's plus one monodromy at Z. So it's sort of a usual disorder operator for the spins. Yeah. It's exactly the same thing. There are more interesting things. I can talk later in more detail. There are actually very interesting things there. And this has more interesting meaning because if you draw the spins here, blue and yellow, then what happens when you go around this point? Then blue spins become yellow because when you go around, you cross perimeter once and blue becomes yellow, but then you return to the same point. So it's sort of this disorder operator that nearby that which changes the value of the spin. Why this picture shifted? No, it was yesterday. It's time dependent. You see, that's it's like with this lemma with the subharmonicity. Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, and let the string theory people.